Hello, friends. This is Anna from Obscuristan. Before we get into the episode, we just had a few announcements. We know that we've been on hiatus for a long time, and we're really excited to be back. We're not promising a episode release schedule just yet, but we will have one soon. Right now, we're just trying to work on growing this project from where we started as a way to tell stories about Eurasia and inform you about Eurasia, to really grappling with our place in the broader leftist movement and resistance against imperialism, and what role we play and what we can learn from each other in trying to combat these issues that are so very important to us and affect our daily lives. To that end, we just wanted to let you know that Obscuristan is joining a larger network started by the Fire These Times podcast. So if you don't already subscribe to the Fire These Times, definitely check it out. We have already had a few guest appearances, which you may have heard. We plan on continuing to collaborate. This episode is a part of that larger collaboration that's starting, and we're really excited for what this larger podcast means for dialogue and solidarity building across regions. So yes, thank you so much for listening. Thank you so much for sticking with us, and let's get to the episode.
Hey everyone, you're listening to Obscuristan, the podcast where we talk about how fucking weird Eurasia is.
And more importantly, how it got that way. We're your hosts. I'm Anna.
I'm Karina.
And without further ado, let's go to Obscuristan. Welcome back, everybody. We're here today with our wonderful friend, Daniel Vosbojnik, from the very exciting upcoming podcast, Hida, which will also be joining our amazing network hosted by The Fire These Times. So definitely check that out when it comes out, and we will definitely be telling you when it comes out. Daniel, I would love it if you could introduce yourself and your background, and then Karina will tell us all what we're here to talk about.
Hi, everyone. I'm Daniel. Firstly, my apologies for my voice. I lost it over the last days, so you might hear me a little bit like an old rock and roll singer. But my name is Daniel. I'm a journalist, writer, campaigner, and I come from a Jewish family from the post-Soviet space. So this topic is very dear to me, and it's an absolute joy to be with you.
Thank you, Daniel. Thank you, Anna. So today we're going to be talking about Alexei Navalny. His death has obviously sparked some reflection about his legacy. And that's something that the three of us who have family ties to Russia and have had different kind of life experiences, either living in Russia or working in Russia, that we wanted to kind of draw from in terms of that experience to flesh out Navalny's legacy from this peripheral kind of experience that we have. So Daniel coming from a Jewish background and Anna and I coming from the Armenian background. And really it's an interesting topic. Navalny was on the one hand this, you know, brave dissident who stood up against perhaps the most powerful autocrat out there today, Putin. And on the other, there are these very kind of problematic vestiges of Navalny's nationalist roots, you know, his expressions of racism, his lack of criticism of Russian imperialism over the years that kind of complicate that legacy. So that's what we're discussing today. And we're super excited to have Daniel on. This is the first time Anna and I have a guest. So we're really kind of honored and privileged to have that. And as Anna mentioned, you know, having joined this larger platform with other folks of different backgrounds, like Daniel, we will be having similar conversations, kind of, you know, having insights from some of the people in this network to help us explore some of these bizarre, often bizarre and fun and grim and dark events and developments of this part of the world. So I want to begin by acknowledging that, you know, while our discussion today pertains to Navalny, we also want to acknowledge the violence that the Russian state is inflicting on Ukrainians in its now 2 years war of aggression. So as we consider Navalny's legacy and the difficulties faced by those challenging Putin and Russia, and, you know, within Russia, we also recognize the Ukrainian people suffering under this kind of nationalist, imperialist, chauvinist invasion. And we express our solidarity to Ukrainians who are giving their lives resisting that same Russian state violence that ultimately killed Navalny. And with that, just, you know, brief background of Navalny, he was probably the most prominent Russian opposition leader of the last 20 years. He gained widespread recognition for his investigations into high-level corruption, using social media and his blog to mobilize public support. He was a vocal critic of President Putin and the ruling United Russia Party. And despite facing legal challenges, multiple arrests, Navalny continued to be a prominent figure in Russian opposition politics, advocating for transparency, accountability, democratic reforms. He was last imprisoned in 2021, eventually ending up at a particularly brutal prison in the Arctic Circle, where he was frequently subjected to solitary confinement. How did he end up there? He was poisoned in August 2020. He fell critically ill during a flight from Siberia to Moscow and was later transferred to a hospital in Berlin for treatment. And the German government, where he received medical care, announced that he was poisoned with a Novichok nerve agent, which is a type of chemical weapon developed in the Soviet Union. He eventually recovered, but not before spending several months in a coma. And according to the EU, the poisoning of Navalny was possible, quote, only with the consent of the presidential executive office and with the participation of the FSB. And an investigation by Bellingcat also implicated agents from the FSB in this poisoning. Once he recovered, he returned to Russia in January 21, where he was promptly arrested by Russian authorities for supposedly violating parole conditions in a previous case, and he was sentenced to 30 years. And this is when he ended up in this penal colony in the tundra. And his death was officially explained as sudden death syndrome, which is like kind of a vague term for different cardiac syndromes that cause sudden cardiac arrest and death. But as with lots of cases in Russia, like, we just don't know what, you know, ultimately killed him. Obviously, if he hadn't been in prison, he, you know, I would surmise would probably still be alive. Russian prisons in general are brutal, and especially this particular one that he was in, and, you know, life expectancy is quite short. So, you know, I don't know. But again, going back to who he was, you know, who was he? And if you kind of, you know, delve into his identity, it's really different depending on who you ask. So for Russians who oppose or are at the very least disheartened with Putin, especially younger people, Navalny was this rare figurehead for anti-establishment feeling. And people outside of Russia, especially in the West, people who maybe, you know, liberals in the West who espouse, you know, democratic values, saw him as this kind of brave, Oscar-winning, you know, guy who, you know, dared kind of oppose Putin. And then there are people who are like us, non-Russian ethnic people in the region, who generally know him for his racism. Obviously, these are kind of like, I'm doing broad strokes here, but just to kind of paint a different picture of the generalities here. Navalny was known for expressing his racist views on Muslims in the Caucasus, in particular, on Georgians and on Central Asian migrants in Russia. And this is, I guess, where I turned to Anna and Daniel for, I don't know, any thoughts, insights about Navalny and his racism, you know, his roots in the nationalist movement.
Yeah, I wanted to ask Daniel specifically, because me and Karina have been talking about Navalny and planning to do an episode about him for like several years now at this point.
It's true.
So I'm wondering, Daniel, like, even before his death, even before, you know, we decided to record about him, what was your kind of impression, or what were your like general thoughts about Navalny?
Thanks so much. I think I start with a tiny bit of hesitation, in the sense that as we speak, right, we're recording this on the 29th of February. The latest news from Moscow is that not a single mortuary, or not a single funeral home is currently willing to transport the hearse of Navalny's body under pressure from the government. So just the context the conversation is happening, it makes, I think, a lot of reflections quite difficult. But I think as many, especially non-ethnic Russians, Navalny always was this figure of with a question mark around him, because he emerged, well, definitely from his youth, had affinity with the Russian nationalist movement. Navalny is someone who, at least from my perspective, has been on multiple political journeys. If there's one thing I think we can't criticize him for, is not changing approaches and changing minds. There are many things that he's never, I think, apologized for in the way that many of us would require. But he's someone who's gone on a journey. But especially in the early days, this is someone that went on Russian nationalist marches. And I think the most generous interpretation of that is, this is someone who wanted to reach Russian nationalist kind of masses. I think in the more realistic interpretations, that this is someone who resonated, who made campaign ads, preying on, I think, Russian populist sentiments around this idea that Russia is in a situation of overly providing for different communities that aren't Russian, ethnic Russians. Mm. And in any case, being this empire of generosity that isn't standing up for its own people, which is a common Russian nationalist narrative. But in any case, I think he represents, I think, the problem with Russian liberalism, which I think refuses to look too askance or too deeply. What are the systematic problems with the Russian empire as a whole? How does it not meet the needs of its own colonial subjects and its own, even the very people that it claims to support? What are the root causes of that? And are those causes just found in one regime or in a pattern of an empire? And rather than really looking critically at these things, was someone that was more readily, at times, interested in putting the blame at some of the most vulnerable and marginalized communities in the Russian Federation. And also, even in his main slogan, that United Russia, which is the ruling party, is a group of crooks and thieves. Is that the diagnosis that's sufficient to explain why Russia hasn't been able to shed totalitarian and authoritarian legacy in present? So I think just from the beginning, though, beyond analysis, as a non-ethnic Russian, I've always just been skeptical of Russian liberalism, just in my instincts, not in some deep analysis. And I think for folks maybe listening outside, I think we can maybe talk together. I think you two might be able to tell this better. Why is making this distinction between ethnic Russians and Russians as a whole so important? And how could we maybe frame that for a wider audience?
I can just speak to exactly what you just said, Daniel, with a personal anecdote. Well, like a series of happenings when I was long time ago interning in Moscow as part of like my Russian language training thing. I interned in Moscow. I grew up in America and I went there as an American citizen, as like a college student. You know, that's where I grew up, and I was American, and I went in, I was like, yeah, you know, I'm learning Russian, I'm American. And they're like kind of just looking at me, trying to figure out my face. And, you know, they would kind of probe further. And then when I would say I was Armenian, they're like, oh, okay. And it was suddenly the relationship would change. And on the one hand, it was like warmer and closer. But on the other hand, the other side of the coin was that I kind of like felt this little sister, kind of like the hierarchy was suddenly evident. Whereas before, as an American, I was kind of equal. I was just like misunderstood or like weird. As soon as I was Armenian, all of my Americanness just kind of melted away. And it's like you try to be a civic, I was a student, I was, you know, I was all these things, right? But it's in Russia, it's like they just never let you forget your national roots. And it's in part because these kind of primordial ideas about ethnicity are still there. Like, because I'm Armenian, I'm like this. I'm, you know, I grew up like this. I have these ideas. This is how I'm going to act, just because, you know, I'm Armenian. It's this natural kind of thing.
I think, yeah, I mean, it's, I want to like be clear about what we're talking about when we talk about Navalny's history of racism. Like he called Georgians rodents. He called for the deportation of Muslim migrant workers. He spoke at Russian marches, which are like groups that bring together far right nationalists, ultra-nationalists, white supremacists, even neo-Nazis. And this was back in the late 2000s. And so I would say this wasn't in like the heyday of like skinheads and neo-Nazis in Russia, but it certainly wasn't long after it. And so the history is pretty severe. But I also, I wanted to like, I don't know, I wanted to address some of the narratives that have arisen about him, because I see these like two very opposing narratives. One is that one that's like certainly being presented in like the European Parliament and the American news, like everywhere, like you see, it's like this was a hero to Russian people, someone who stood, you know, in principled opposition against Putin, and who was murdered in cold blood. And then the other narrative is who is Alexei Navalny? Well, he's a violent white supremacist. He's a fascist. He's a nationalist. And I'm not sorry he's dead. And this I see primarily from like a lot of the left. And then anyway, and I this isn't even to say that this is like a majority opinion held on the left, because God knows how you would even pull that. But it is certainly like a narrative that has arisen, and anyone who's not participating in it hasn't like, there isn't a lot of like dialogue about it. I definitely see some people like popping up and suggesting that like, well, I'm on the Russian left or the Ukrainian left and I supported Navalny. But it's not like there really isn't like, I don't know. I don't think as strong a narrative has arisen that I don't even want to say is in between these two, because I actually think that like, it's not about like finding a middle ground at all. It's just about like reconciling two very real realities about this person. And the conclusion that I sort of came to was that, you know, half the people are overestimating his politics. And then the other half are underestimating his importance. And to me, it just kind of it brings up like the question of like the broader question of like, well, what role do like neoliberal or liberal opposition leaders play for the left? And in what context can they even play a role? So yeah, that's kind of, I feel like that was the framing that I walked into this with. And I also want to be clear that Navalny was very clearly like a liberal or neoliberal figure. His like primary battle was against corruption. And when he talked about like migration or immigration, his like whole solution to it was to like standardize a system in the style of like European countries to like be able to manage it with a visa program. Which, you know, when you're familiar with migration and immigration, you're like, well, that didn't help a ton. Like it just created a standardized program to institutionalize abuse in a lot of instances. But is it in some ways better than the Russian system, which currently is like also just extremely exploitative of Central Asian workers and leaves them without any rights? And not just Central Asian workers, Armenian workers, Georgian workers, like there are a lot of migrant workers into Russia, and they're all sort of left without any status and without any rights, to the point where like we've talked about this before, but they're exploited in pretty severe ways. So these are like all questions that I've been trying to like grapple with in my own head, and that we've been talking about for I don't know how many years at this point.
I think both of what you just said, both Daniel and Anna, kind of goes into this thinking that I was also having when I was kind of reading about Navalny to kind of refresh, you know, my knowledge about it. But it's like, on the one hand, he was an activist, right? And on the other, he was a politician. And while these two roles kind of overlap for him, I think the expectations that he kind of more effectively embody maybe more kind of social justice, anti-imperialist aspirations and goals, kind of like completely neglected that his role and kind of how he saw himself as this aspirational political leader. I mean, he was an activist, but he was also trying to get elected. And that means that no, he was not likely to be anti-imperialist. And obviously his contributions to the Russian opposition and Russian movement building are significant. And even within like the Russian marches that he would attend in the Russian nationalist movement, this was a movement that, like as Anna explained, you know, in the late 2000s was this kind of heyday. It started becoming much more mainstream. And when Putin came back to power right after Medvedev in 2011, late 2011, 2012, the protests that it sparked across the country were so diverse. I mean, it was Russian marches, but it was also environmental activists. It was also, you know, ethno-nationalist movements in the regions before, you know, things kind of crystallized and people realized, well, actually, if Navalny is going to be the leader of this kind of anti-Putin movement, which at the time he wasn't, he was just one of the prominent guys. It just kind of became, well, we can't get behind this. And I was doing my fieldwork in the North Caucasus at the time, and there were so many non-Russian ethnic, in this case, Muslims, telling me they were so tired of Putin and his politics, and they were really waiting for somebody to come along. They just couldn't get behind Navalny because of his racism. So it was just this, you know, you could see this lost opportunity. Whereas Navalny probably saw it in a different way. He was just trying to appeal to the mainstream. So he stopped attending the Russian marches in 2013. That was, or sorry, 2011, I think was the, or 2012, I'm sorry. It's around that time. He stopped attending, saying that he didn't condemn it. He actually said he supported the Russian march and good for them. I hope, you know, that they have it and it's good. I'm just not going to join because the explanation he used was, I'm trying to get elected. I know he, at that point, he had been elected or he'd come in second for Moscow mayor. And he was saying that because of that sort of success, that electoral success, he felt like he needed to still kind of appeal to the broadest possible segment of Russian society and that he had this responsibility since that sort of success to eschew that kind of explicit kind of association with the nationalist movement.
Thanks so much. I think both of you raised to me, I think the crucial, one crucial kind of skill, I think, especially in navigating Eurasia or any complex context is, can we have the capacity to hold multiple things at once? Can we both understand that confronting the intense authoritarianism of Putinism takes an enormous amount of courage and skill. And Navalny is one of the most talented populist communicators I've ever seen. I think it's hard to understand for non-Russian speakers, but someone with a level of charisma and an ability to pierce through the media, the amount of media and the landscape of media conversation in Russia is so different to other media landscapes. It takes a lot of skill to pierce through the nonsense. And I think this is someone who had a remarkable ability and had a level of courage that many, many other people did not. And at the same time represented a politics that was, as you were saying, Karen, highly exclusionary and highly racist. And what I find most interesting in the conversation on Navalny after his assassination, we can call it, is that some of the people I think that are most excluded from the conversation, mainly leaders from minorities within the Russian Federation, from indigenous communities, actually said, you know, we salute this person as someone who struggled against the regime. But we, if our condemnation is one of naivete, we know that this is an empire. We know that you're facing an empire. Join with us, if you would have joined with us more. And if anything, the naivete is the same naivete that indigenous movements have criticized in the Belarusian protests, for example, that liberal politics can't dismantle an empire. Mm. So I've seen some of the most nuanced, interesting, and complex perspectives on Navalny actually come from the communities that he most alienated. Then they very much saw his bravery, and they saw in his bravery the bravery of their own struggle, their own people, and yet saw also that the model of communications and expression that Navalny used also wasn't enough. And I think that if anything, you know, I honor his bravery, and I think that we can talk more about what that bravery means. It was also quite a macho, patriarchal bravery. But the naivete was real as well, in the assumption that through anti-corruption communication, that through certain kinds of bravery alone, that would be enough to push people into taking the kind of liberal civil disobedience that would push this regime over the edge. And that hasn't really proven. Who knows what time will say, but I'm curious on how we can cultivate what you have cultivated in this podcast, which is how do we hold multiple truths at once and also not just jump into this anti-imperialism of idiots spiel, which I've seen many of the kind of the Kremlin RT-funded outlets say that a Russian racist politician has died, which to me is such a disservice to also so many also activists who from different minorities who joined the Navalny movements, I think from a perspective of thinking it was the best thing in town. And I don't want to simply put them all into one category, if that makes sense.
I think people don't always conceptualize the way in which activism can manifest in under a regime as oppressive and, I guess, like violent against its own people as the Putin regime. And that's not even to say that like there isn't like oppression or I've seen very clearly, for example, the like ways in which the U.S. government is oppressive towards like people speaking out against it in the last several months, especially after, you know, the genocide in Palestine started. But that being said, like coming out and like in protest in Russia, it won't just get you beaten by cops. It could get you killed. And this is something that's been shown like very clearly for a long time. And so it's a different paradigm. And so for people to choose to go and protest, the level of risk is inherently very high. And so you have to, like, if you're an activist in this space, you really, like, every action you take, you're putting life and limb on the line. The calculations that you make are going to be different. You might say, like, I actually might fucking hate this guy, but he's gathering a movement and, like, there's inertia. And for that, like, my risk is worth it. And I've never had to make a calculation like that. So it's, and I see with my own eyes, like a lot, like Daniel, as you were saying, like a lot of like minority groups in Russia and a lot of people like of minorities in Russia who supported Navalny enormously. I see it in my own community too. Like Navalny news is on all of the time among like Armenians and like a lot of like, you know, former Soviet people that I like interact with. Like that's something they consume a lot. It's where they get their information about, you know, the war on Ukraine. And so it's really like the network that he built is incredibly powerful. And honestly, maybe even one day we should do an episode about like the broader sprawling network of like activists and commentators and like even like local political leaders or like smaller political leaders that Navalny TV or his broad network created. But I still find myself really struggling with it because I don't know, like I'm also coming from the perspective of and maybe this is like touching fire, but I'm coming from the perspective of the 2018 revolution in Armenia, which bore out a lot of destruction in some ways. But I remember speaking to friends and I remember speaking to like leftists in Armenia who understood that this was not like a left-wing movement, but it was like one of their first opportunities to be heard en masse about the repression they were facing in their country. But I also see now the like results of that revolution, which include like an expanded police state, for example. And so to me, like it really is an open question of like, what role do neoliberal or liberal opposition, like genuine opposition leaders have for leftist movements? Because I think the thing that I think like everyone has to acknowledge is that this was a genuine opposition movement. This wasn't one that was folded into like a state apparatus. It was not convenient for Putin or his government. It wasn't convenient for Russian Empire either. Should Navalny's movement have been able to like gain power, it would cause genuine disruption to the Russian regime. I think that is like very obviously clear. But that being said, like in causing genuine disruption to the Russian regime, I ask what would have been disrupted and what is the movement that he has now left behind? Because I was listening to his Yulia Navalny's speech in the European Parliament, I think it was. And Galina and I actually sent her speech after her husband was murdered. And that first speech that she gave, I mean, like both Galina and I were blown away. Like it was incredibly emotional, incredibly strong. And it's like impossible not to empathize and sympathize with this woman and also like see her strength. But at the same time, you know, I was listening to the speech that she gave in the European Parliament and she said something very interesting, which was that my husband understood that Putin is she effectively called him a gangster. Like he is he has a criminal gang. And to me, hearing the language of like criminality used and not the language of politics, because she was saying this is not a politician, this is a criminal. And that, I think, is accurate to how Navalny saw Putin. And I know for a fact that so many people agree with that. I know how many people do. But to me, that indicates this idea that like we are all in the law. This is an outlaw. And so like it feels like the anger is at the deinstitutionalization, is at the like haphazard way in which the Russian state kills. It's at a lack of institutions versus the violence and the murder itself. And I do think that like a lack of institutionalization does increase violence often. Like I really do think that's true. But it's very, it's disorienting, I have to say. And the other thing that she said was that we need your support from the European Parliament. And she said, and the way that you deal with the criminal gang is you root out its co-conspirators in your countries. And then I immediately thought to, who was it? Was it Nancy Pelosi who called Palestinian protesters like Russian agents? Because on the one hand, you've got Russian activists like screaming that this was their one shot. They like they believe in this man and this movement because they are tired of this like fundamentally imperialist state. But on the other hand, you also have like the like Western imperialism, which is ready to sort of fold this movement into its own goals. And I honestly like figuring out how to be in opposition to that is fucking insane. I really resent people who treat it like it's simple because I'm finding it genuinely difficult.
I think actually what you just said is so super interesting, Anna, about like what you described. I just realized as you were speaking, the tactics, a lot of the tactics that Navalny used was just emblematic of the Russian opposition, liberal elite opposition. And I found that a lot of movements, even in the regions, kind of took that and borrowed it because that was the conceptual framework that everyone was operating under. And I wonder to what extent that is conditioned by this like very, you know, non-democratic context and the lack of formal channels for dissent. And, you know, even when you look at social movement literature about mobilization, there are certain conditions required in order for a movement to even be able to mobilize. And one of them is a free media. And the other one is lack of state repression. And that just wasn't true in Russia. Like that just completely, you know, went against. I'm sure the scholarship is like, you know, updated to address that. There's probably other cases as well. But what he was doing was this classic, almost standard Russian protest tactic. Like he would, for example, do things through the formal political system, like lawsuits against yes. prisons, right? But he did that. I think he thought he was like subverting the system by kind of, you know, showing, it's like holding a mirror to the system to show how, you know, contradictory it is. And for example, like how he sued the penal colony he was in for not being allowed books, right? He makes these appeals, he makes these formal appeals fully knowing that the judge is not going to rule in his favor. But he does it as it's his protest tactic. It's his way to kind of lay bare the system's senseless, kind of indiscriminate cruelty, not just to Russians, his audience, right, but also to the system itself, like holding that mirror. So, for you know, instance, when he was doing the penal colony, his court speech, that was like the performance. That was his protest speech. But he does it from within the system's framework. So in the speech, I just want to just like briefly go through it. He recounts how a priest visited him in his cell and gifted him a book on divine law. And the priest kind of tells him, you know, Alexei, it's pointless to read the Bible without reading divine law. Like, please read them together. But due to new rules in the penal colony, he was only allowed to have one book. So he points out like how unusual this is, given that historically more books were allowed, even during the Soviet era. And you know he mentions Soviet dissident Natan Sharansky, who he actually was writing letters to while he was imprisoned. That guy was permitted 5 books, right? So he makes this like really well-founded argument about this absurd rule about not having not being allowed books. And then turns it into this broader argument about how that rule was in place to discourage the study of Islam. So it was like this Islamophobic rule that, you know, and he was right about that. He was right that,
which is, you know, wild because yeah, like his past on Islam was insane.
Yeah, it was horrible. And, you know, without going into it, and maybe for some audience members who aren't, you know, aware, but, you know, Russia waged a racist imperialist, you know, quote unquote, war against terror of its own for over a decade, starting in the 1990s in the North Caucasus and against Chechnya in particular. And he makes this argument saying that because of this rule, that outcome actually affected Christians like him. And it was, you know, infringing on his right to practice his religion in prison. So it's just this, you know, I think it's uncommon probably to witness such revelations wherein like the fundamental contradictions in logic of this like cruel, stark state system and the utter senselessness of it, of the penitentiary system in particular, they're laid bare by this, you know, by arguably like the second most powerful person in the country, politician.
Yeah, I wonder if the Navalny who came out of incarceration would have been this, like, I mean, obviously not, but the, like, politically would have been the same as the one who entered incarceration. But you were saying about the tactics. I want to, like, I read a book which, like, documents in an interview or, like, a conversation between Navalny and a Polish dissident named Micznik. And it talks about, like, some of his tactics, and it also talks about, like, the framework that they fall into. So, for example, I'm so glad you brought this up. So in 2007, he began to buy small numbers of shares in large state companies and to turn up at their annual meetings and ask embarrassing questions. In a widely read blog, he exposed corrupt activities of the regime's insiders and heaped ridicule on Kremlin's explanations. Navalny's anti-corruption foundation soon became a kind of incubator for online civic activism projects. One site, Rasyama, enables Russians to quickly and painlessly demand road repairs. And, like, all the user has to do is, like, print out and mail the forms. And so his goal, as he said, was to make it easy for everyone to spend 15 minutes a day struggling against the regime, which, like, is interesting because, like, there's something very almost, like, perfectly American about that. He was modeling after, like, Amnesty International. Like, it's like there is something that, like, fits into, like, oh, it's literally, like, an active shareholder. Like, there's a lot about, like, capital in there. But at the same time, like, this fell into form of dissidence that, like, rose in Czechoslovakia, and it was the philosophy of the playwright Václav Havel, who wrote in The Power of the Powerless, the main idea behind living within the truth, quote unquote, in Havel's phrase, and quote, living in dignity, unquote, in Galakovsky's, was to behave as if one were in a free country. The goal was to create a free public sphere to substitute for the one controlled by the authorities. Instead of complaining about censorship, citizens should publish their own books and newspapers. Rather than accept historical distortions, they should write and teach their own history. And unlike the conspiratorial movements of the past, they should do all this openly and, where possible, invite their police handlers to the conversation. So it's like, it's very Soviet, I think. Like, it makes sense in the context of, like, what the Soviet Union looked like, how to, like, struggle against, like, the kind of repression faced there. I wonder if that, like, that legacy of, like, struggling against Soviet repression, I wonder if it's actually, like, hindered the ability of Russians and other former Soviet states to, like, people living in former Soviet states to organize opposition. Because I think you're used to opposing, like, a really specific kind of regime. And I don't know, like, to me, like, states now just look very different. I wonder if the same use exists. I don't know.
At least in terms of tactics, I think the Russian, from 2012, there was a lot of innovation in tactics. And there was a lot of this kind of performative stuff, like fake funerals, et cetera. Like, I mean, maybe not in content, just in terms of style. But I think one of the main things that changed, it was the use of the internet. So in 2011, 2012, during this kind of burgeoning of, mass anti-Putin protest activity across Russia, I think in large part, it was also due to the fact that these activists and movements had figured out how to use the internet to gain support, to actually reach broader audiences, kind of say, hey, this thing is happening, you know, join us on Saturday at 3 p.m. in the main square, and people would show up. And it was a really interesting period of time, a window that soon closed after, because that's when the Russian state started kind of getting smart to those tactics and started using the internet for its own, you know, state repression, for surveillance, for co-optation, which, you know, ultimately, I think in a sad way ended, you know, with where we are now, which is Navalny being dead and this kind of sense of despair. I think I had this interesting conversation with someone else. We were talking about the difference between when, you know, Navalny died, was killed, versus when Boris Nemtsov, who was probably maybe number two in terms of prominence, he was killed a few years ago, quite provocatively, right outside the Kremlin. And it was outside the Kremlin walls. back then it almost seemed like a trigger for potentially something bigger. Like this could trigger something big, that there's going to be a change here and it could be good. It ended up not being good. Whereas Navalny, his death is kind of a nail in the coffin. There's no window here that I see. And that's my kind of non-optimistic take on things. But I think I wanted to ask Daniel, because you had mentioned earlier, you said something about, you know, this sort of political maturation that people talk about when they talk about Navalny's, you know, journey, I guess, as a political figure. And you said you were quite skeptical of that. You know, the speech that he gave in prison, or sorry, in the court about the prison, about the books and the Quran, and kind of almost seemingly defending Muslims. As Anna said, you know, would he say that if he was not in prison? You know, that's kind of a question. And I guess I'm wondering, like, what's your take on this kind of positive look on him, on his like self-reflection, his looking at his tactics and apologizing for some of his racist statements in the past, but, you know, maybe not all of them, or like, how do you see that?
I think it's a really good question. And I think, look, I can only speak from where I stand, and not being in Russia right now is a stance of privilege. I am interested in politics because I believe in transformation, and I believe that people, all people, have the capacity to transform. I don't think anyone's born a Russian imperialist nationalist. You're born into a society, a family that normalizes that. And so when I see that someone towards the end of their life, before their assassination, was defending the rights of Muslim political prisoners, to me that, and also that's not just symbolic. I think, and smarter people than me, people like Masha Gessen, for example, have looked at, you know, his nationalism did change and from away from this much more ethnic nationalism towards a more civic nationalism. And whether we, you know, with all the critiques of Navalny, the intense xenophobia softened in the discourse and in the organizing. And in fact, I would say that some of the bigger criticisms you can make towards the later Navalny is that there wasn't enough of a vision. I think that when it comes down to it, I was hearing Omar Barghouti recently, the Palestinian activist, reflect on despair as the colonization of the future. And I think in Russia, if anything, you know, the sense of despair, the way in which the future has been so intensely colonized by the Putinist regime, Navalny was one of the few people who allowed people to even think that there was another kind of future. Now, I'm not going to say that Navalny is some kind of decolonizer, but in a context as brutal as Russia, I think we have to be very kind of sanguine sometimes about who is actually shaking people's capacity to even acknowledge that the limits of the possible are there to be moved. In a state where the government relies upon people's forced complete paralysis and complete desire to do nothing. And seeing that so many people, especially in Russia's most peripheral regions, especially given that we need Russians to basically shake the system up for the benefit of Ukrainians, for the benefit of all in Syrians, all those affected by Russian imperialism. I'm not sure what he would have been like outside of prison. It's a very hard question to answer, but I'm sure that a Navalny that was more plugged in to the narratives of organizers on the ground, for example, now in Bashkortostan, which I think if any place is shaking things up in Russia, it's Bashkortostan.
Yeah.
What could have it looked like? A Navalny maybe radicalized by a penitentiary experience in touch with the brutality of what that system has looked like. Since Tsarist era, the Russian penitentiary system has been the weapon of silencing all dissident voices. It's seeing that the latest liberal hope has been turned, extinguished in a prison in Siberia, in Arkhangel, in the Arctic. It's so familiar to anyone familiar with radical revolutionary movements from across the Russian Empire for before even the Soviet era. So I'm not sure. I'm not in any ways. I want us to always be in touch with hope, because despair, once again, is the colonization of hope. And I think there is a parallel universe in which mistakes are learned and the liberal Russian movement becomes more playful in its repertoire of tactics. So I don't want to just tap into a narrative where it was all hopeless from the start. And I want us to imagine, in honoring the best parts of the memory of Navalny and Navalnism, what could it have looked like? And is there anything about that question of what could it have looked like that can help us in the now, in a time when the Russian Empire marches on, when the situation in Ukraine looks horrifically grim, the situation in Armenia also looks horrifically grim. What is it that we can learn at this moment? Is there anything that's worth keeping from Navalnism that we want to keep the fire alive of, but with deep, deep lessons from other territories that are frequently not listened to and actively ignored from the Russian intelligentsia and the Russian liberal circuits? That's the question I'm curious for both of you.
Daniel, that's brilliant. Sorry, I was just like struck for a second by how...
Yeah, same. I'm just humbled into silence right now. Just kind of, you know, chewing on what you've just said and the question you've just posed.
From the same book that documented this conversation I was mentioning, there's actually a section where Navalny talks about nationalism and imperialism. And he says something I think is interesting because, Daniel, you said that, like, I wouldn't describe Navalny as some kind of decolonizer, although he is providing a space in which people can imagine a different future. And that, I think, is like, I think you're so right that that's enormously important and powerful. But he said, so interestingly, I don't think you would describe him as a decolonizer. I certainly wouldn't. I'm not even sure I would describe him as an anti-imperialist, but I think he would describe himself as an anti-imperialist because he says, imperialist nationalism is the most toxic and dangerous of all the varieties of nationalism. It has to be combated. We have to understand that there cannot be a vacuum. Everywhere you go, there will be a conservative, national-oriented segment of the population, and these people need to be provided with an alternative project. A civic nationalism, as Daniel mentioned, predicated not on physiology or a sense of national superiority, but on universal civil rights and freedoms and the potential to determine the fate of our country together. And this is a real possibility. I've invested a lot of effort into this and hope to reestablish some kind of dialogue.
Anna, can you tell me when he made that statement? Because that'll help me understand it.
Yes, it was written in 2015.
Interesting.
He talks a bit about how, like, you know, he talks a bit about his image as a nationalist and how he's like just kind of like shot himself in the foot because people see him as a nationalist. And then the ones like who are actually nationalists don't actually care. But I don't know. To me, I think that it became clear that he had some kind of like internal sense of anti-imperialism when he stood very clearly against the war in like the war on Ukraine. And that was something I didn't actually fully expect from the Russian opposition. Like, I'm going to be honest, I was quite pessimistic and I did not expect the kind of mobilization against this war that was evident. That being said, I don't think like he's actually positing a vision that I would consider anti-imperialist because I don't think he realizes the full scope of empire period, but specifically of Russian empire. Like, he talks also at length about like introducing the visa regime for Central Asian migrants. And he speaks about it saying like, well, this is to ensure their rights because like if somebody, you know, they would be required to have medical insurance, they'd actually be able to go get treatment for like workplace injuries and things like that. And that's totally like that's true. But he also references like, I think we should learn from the civilized nations of the world how this is done. And you see the blind spot and the like goal all in one. Where it's like, okay, yes, like migrant workers need to have explicit protections written into law that protect their ability to seek medical care, be able to like find housing, not be discriminated against in housing, have their salaries and their paychecks protected and their identities protected and all of these things. But the visa regime itself, that's the process that excludes people. It's the other protections that give them ability to do these things. So I wonder if, not I wonder, I think frequently about how much the Soviet Union's legacy of socialism poisoned socialism for opposition forever, I feel like. And hopefully not forever, but like really kind of poisoned the idea of being decolonial, anti-empire. Because these were words that were like weaponized by an imperial state. Like they talked so much about like being in solidarity with like against empire. And for people living in Armenia, Georgia, like the central, like, you know, you were kind of like, what the fuck? and I wonder like, you mentioned, like you said, he is a politician. He had goals. He had goals of like getting elected, of gathering coalitions and all of these things. But where does that leave the left? Where does that leave like us in organizing and how to organize around him? Because is he right? Or like, is this calculation that he's made right that you can't be left-wing activist in Russian spaces or in post-Soviet spaces because there's a history of the Soviet Union. Is it just impossible to gather a coalition like that? So if we're going to engage in this project that he left us, the ability to imagine a future, I wonder, like, how can we preserve leftism for the former Soviet Union? Like, how can we preserve it in a truly principled way, in a way that like can actually push it forward?
I think especially since the war in Ukraine, decolonial discourse has really taken off in this space, and particularly in Central Asia. And Arma and I have had a podcast episode about that. And I wonder if Navalny wasn't imprisoned again, you know, thinking about the what ifs is kind of a pointless exercise. But sometimes I wonder, because you clearly see his limitations and the almost contradictory statements that he wants to be the good guy. He wants to say the good thing, but you see his kind of the limitations in his framework and his worldview, that he's just not, he's like almost there. He's like so close, and he's not quite getting there. And in other cases, I've found that you, even in like statements that are made close together, or, you know, the sentiment, it doesn't match the immediate thing he's saying. So it's almost like he can't figure it out. You're watching him struggle with it. So just as an example, in 2014, he gave an interview about, I mean, this is just after the annexation of Crimea, and he was asked to whom that region belonged. And he responded, and this is quote, "Crimea belongs to the people who live in Crimea. The peninsula was seized in blatant violation of all international norms, but it is now part of Russia and will remain so. It will never become part of Ukraine again soon. Is Crimea sandwiched with sausage to be passed back and forth?" So it's just the avoiding, you know, just trying to placate and please as many people as possible, while at the same time not saying the thing. He also frequently deployed that notion of Ruski Mir, the Russian world, which is like this key component of Putin's foreign policy. And he wasn't critical of it at all. And again, for our listeners, Russian world concept represents this broad kind of area of Russian political, military, economic, cultural influence, mainly within the former Russian Empire and the Soviet Union territories. And it's based on, you know, the Russian Orthodox faith, Slavic roots, Russian language as this unifying factor. And in 2018, he criticized Putin for allowing Ukraine to create its own autocephalous church. And he called him the enemy of the Russian world. So, you know, it's not that, you know, imperialist policy is what was wrong. It was the way that, you know, Putin didn't kind of wield it in an effective manner. That was what was disappointing. So again, it's like the framework is in there, kind of going back to your broader question on about, you know, where does this leave leftist discourse, thought, movement building in this post kind of communist, post-socialist space that let so many people down. It's really, I see it in the obstacles of like the structural movement building, like the way people relate to one another, the institutions that exist that you have to kind of navigate. It just seems like the obstacles are so many.
I wonder if instead of being left with the limitations of Navalny's politics, it makes sense to, like Daniel said, take from him the fact that like opposition exists, discomfort exists, like possibility exists, but remember that the organizing and maybe even like political awakening that needs to happen hasn't happened yet. And I think about this frequently when I think about a lot of how many of the Russian dissidents went to Israel to like escape Russia's war, imperialist war on Ukraine, and how vapid and empty that is, and how it's still sort of like predicated on like a civilized world like versus the uncivilized world sense of things. And I wonder if there's something that, like, I don't know, I start to think maybe it's showing us where the awakenings haven't happened yet. But I also think of all of the, you know, Russian emigres and immigrants in Armenia. And I start to think of like the people who have stayed and how I've observed their politics change or become a little bit more like awakened to the actual detailed and like nuanced realities of Russian imperialism around in like surrounding areas, and also in part like in parts of the state of Russia. And I wonder if like sort of like real organizing that needs to happen is in looking at the groups who were activated by Navalny's activism, but not satisfied by it, I guess. Yeah.
I think that's a really, really interesting approach. And I'm very, in the long term, I'm really curious how the experience of exile for a lot of Russian emigres, especially in contexts like Armenia. I mean, I've also heard some really bad stories, of course, of people bringing that imperialist.
Oh, hell yeah.
Oh, yeah. So I'm, you will know much better than me about, but I've had obviously terrible things in Georgia. But I'm also hopeful in the sense that, like, first of all, we're commanded to be hopeful. And if one source to me of immense despair and hope at the same time is just reading testimonies of some of my political heroes resisting the Russian Empire 130 years ago, feeling like I'm reading the same thing right now. So much hasn't changed, but also so much is possible, and things collapse at all sorts of moments and for ways that we can never predict. When I think of Navalny, what I stay with is, you know, this person had an incredible gift for being a populist, which is a loaded word, but when I look at how they communicated, for example, I mean, the brazenness. Navalny is a shareholder activist, basically bought some shares, looked into the accounting reports of companies like Transneft and Rosneft, and drove a truck through them because they were so sloppy.
He cut off his own ankle monitor and then just like went walking around like Russia, literally took a photo of it and then just went walking around Russia until his police handlers were just like gave up.
Yeah, like this the chutzpah in the best sense. The FBK people just bought some drones and flew the drones over the houses. I think also the level of corruption that we're working with in the Russian Empire is not like some low-key kind of like, oh, someone put some money under the table. We're talking about people buying the most obscene, ridiculous levels of luxury when an entire public health system is collapsing, when people are spending money invading Ukraine and completely ignoring the needs of the population. I think the mistake is then sometimes joining the dots. And also, I think the big mistake, I think, of Russian liberals is this kind of, I think, what you're hinting at, this turn to civilized Europe. And I think it's also a mistake I'm hearing in the Ukrainian left as well. The model is Europe or Israel. Mm-hmm. This idea that there's this kind of civilization and we're living in barbarism. And in fact, I think the hope of anywhere lies in the diasporas, in the regions, in the minorities that know what it's like to resist empire for centuries. It's not just the Russian Federation. It's not just the Soviet regime. It's a story, a legacy, especially from indigenous communities, from diasporas, from survivors of genocide from the Russian Empire. What does it mean to endure this for centuries? And there's practices there that the Russian opposition have rarely tapped into because of this Eurocentrism, I think. And I think if we're able to take the best of Navalny's populist communication tactics and braid it together with some of the really fascinating conversations on decolonizing the Russian Empire that are taking place in Armenia and Georgia and Kazakhstan and so many places, what does that do for us? Could something be there? I don't want to be naive because I think that's repeating the mistake of Navalnyism, but could we look in other ways? And I think you two already in Obskuristan have looked in other ways. And I'm curious if we can keep on doing that.
That was, yeah, great. I mean, I think many of us non-Russian people who are from or have ties to Russia and the region have this skepticism, right, towards Russian liberals. And I think in a broader sense, liberals of former empires often struggle to kind of shed those chauvinistic attitudes, whether they're ethnic or religious or et cetera, towards those neighboring countries. You know, and this is the case in the Middle East, right, where liberals in many countries, you know, abandon their self-professed values to justify ethnic cleansing and dehumanization of, you know, often Arab Muslim peoples, like in Palestine. And, you know, this raises important questions. And I think embracing liberalism having that liberalism out there, having those elites out there, doesn't give us any reassurance to us, to the peripheral nations, to the minorities, similar groups, because it inherently lacks these humanizing characteristics. It fails to offer solidarity. It overlooks our lived experiences. And it falls short as this kind of corrective measure that, you know, against the mass kind of violence that we see being perpetrated by their states, whether it's Russia or Israel or Azerbaijan or, you know, whatever it is. And so the need for alternatives becomes evident. So I almost feel like, and especially with the war in Ukraine, that this kind of door has been opened to start talking about this stuff. And one of the interesting things that I find is, like, especially in Central Asia, because Russian it has been so dominant, the Russian language, which is not the case in Armenia, for example, how much of this stuff is being done in non-Russian languages. So it's funny because Russian being the unifying language as a kind of as a result of these imperial policies was a way for us to talk to one another, but for some reason it wasn't happening, like, horizontally. It was always kind of through the Russian lens. And I hope that that might be something that we change, that whether that's through discovering or, like, learning or centering our national languages more, or speaking, you know, in other languages. I know there's this critique of using English as an alternative, because that's also kind of, you know, could be potentially problematic and colonizing in and of itself. But I think in this context, you know, practically speaking, English isn't the language, you know, that world isn't what's kind of has colonized us in the past and has caused violence, but or subjected people to violence. But it's just that I think about these things and think about how we can foster these conversations across these divides in more ways, different ways.
I'm so ambivalent about the speaking of Russian or, like, the not speaking of Russian. My guiding principle is, how can I be most annoying in the correct situation? But I think that something that actually has been pretty, like, powerful for me has been hearing and speaking Russian in decolonial contexts, actually, because that is not a context in which I've ever heard Russian in my entire life. You know, if I was speaking Russian, it was...
Yeah.
If I was speaking Russian, it was usually almost always with somebody who thought they were better than me. Or it was with my family with whom, like, it was so Russian, true. Armenian, like... I almost, like, see our family's Russian as, like, separate from Russian altogether sometimes. But now getting to speak Russian in contexts that are not like that, that are explicitly decolonial, even, like, as simple as, like, starting to, like, try and find anti-imperialist voices in Russian and hearing them has been really nice for me. I really enjoy it. I'm glad to have a language in which I can speak to people from Kazakhstan in. I'm glad to have a language in which I can communicate with Georgians in. There's a lot of work to be done to create the solidarity, not through the Russian lens, but whatever connection I have to, like, people from that, like, you know, like, Tatar people, Kazakh people, like, I'm taking it. Like, I'm really grateful to be able to do that. And I think that, Daniel, I don't know, like, I keep thinking about what you said about the creation of, like, a space in which you can hope. The thing that I kept trying to ask myself was, why was I so honestly affected by Navalny's murder in a way that I don't think I would have been had, like, a, like, Democrat in the U.S. died, for example, even if they were murdered. Like, I'm not sure I would be quite as affected by it. And I realized it was because the particular manifestation, I think you made me realize that the particular manifestation of repression in Russia is its primary focus is on taking away the ability to think of alternatives or alternative futures. In the US, I feel like the particular focus is slightly different in that it's just, like, a limitation of the alternative futures instead. In Russia, there's a real, like, hard hammering on, like, nah, you've got one future and this is it. And that removal of choice, as opposed to the illusion of choice, creates a, like, depression of imagination that's really, it's hard to snap out of. And I think that's why 2018 in Armenia was so, like, powerful for people, and why the disappointment was so, so deep. It's because you were given permission to, like, think beyond, and then to feel that taken away is, I think, really horrific. And so I think maybe his death, it feels like that's been taken away. But I think Daniel's right that we can use whatever we have learned from the success of his ability to rally support, but apply to it our own politics, our own goals, and our own vision for what this region is going to look like. And our vision for a region beyond Russia, because something Karina and I have been discovering as we, like, talk about Obscuristan is that, you know, from talking from an Armenian perspective, we reach into Russia or towards Russia as often as we reach towards the Middle East, or as often as we reach towards, you know, Anatolia. And so, like, the Russian world cut off so many people from their, like broad, much, much more far-reaching histories. And so I think, like, you know, Navalny may have seen his movement as in the Russian world, but I'm beginning to realize that it's beyond it. And I'm not saying it's like obviously it's global, blah, blah, blah. I don't want to be cliche, but like there are like specific connections that are not being tapped into that we're starting to now. And we can like use what we've learned, but move beyond it too, I think.
I love that. I love that so much. And also it's why I love this conversation, because interdiasporic conversations means that borders lose their power. And we can talk about, when we're talking about Navalny, we're talking about who are the people breaking through forces of authoritarianism, whether it's anywhere in the world. And diasporas allow you to think in multi-rootedness all the time. And this is why, to me, I mean, this is like being with family. And I really appreciate that.
Daniel, I'm so glad you said that, because we shit on diasporas so much. It's nice to see them as like a place for like something better.
it's the only hope, really, in the sense that how do you crumple the Russian Empire? I have no idea. I think people have been struggling with this question. But if there's any hope, it's the fact that people have been migrating and smuggling and getting ideas out and sharing links across communities and different diasporas, different nations inside the famous Cemetery of Nations, the Graveyard of Nations, have been with each other's backs all the time. I'm not going to like romanticize diasporas. There's all sorts going on. But for every story of betrayal, there are stories of salvation, of different people saving each other along the way. And you know, the activists in my diasporic tradition that I value the most are the ones that say, I am with the Bashkir people, I'm with the Armenian people in imagining a future beyond imperialism and building, as Masha Gessen says, the Birabijan in my mind. You know, the Birabijan, this kind of famous, the Jewish Autonomous Republic obelisk that the Soviet Union wanted to put Jews in the middle of Siberia. And instead of imagining this as a territorial place, what's the Birabijan in my mind? When I think about what this, you know, the Soviet Union of my dreams, the real Soviet Union, not the nonsense that was real, the Soviet Union where peoples were united and supportive of each other's liberation. I dream about that sometimes. And I'm curious on what it looks like. And it doesn't involve a state. It involves a way of being. And if the Russian language helps us get there, then it's useful. If the Russian language becomes a machine of colonization as it has been, then it's useless. But I think of, to me, when I think of what Eurasia is in the best sense, the thing that brings me together is humor. And there's a Russian language comedy night in Barcelona, which is the most surreal experience. It's a mixture of like Ukrainians, Armenians, Georgians, and, you know, wealthy Russian emigres who just rocked up from Dubai. And the space where a Ukrainian can make fun of Russians in Russian in their face, and the Armenian can then make fun of Ukrainians, and the Russian Jewish comedian can go up and start talking about what it's like to be a Russian Jew. And we all laugh and we realize that we have far more in common than has been told in any nonsense nationalist textbook. That's the utopian diasporic liquid nation that I want to be part of. And that's the hope. That's my hope, at least.
That's amazing and beautiful. And I can't think of a better way to conclude this episode. Probably like the most just, I don't know, heartwarming. Is that cliche?
I was not expecting this one to end up being hopeful, actually.
Yeah. And just kind of like cozy somehow.
Thank you, everybody, for listening. Please subscribe to Obscuristan if you haven't already. And please go listen to Daniel's Hida, because it's forthcoming soon. Daniel, when is it forthcoming?
Soon. Like very soon. Weeks. We're talking about weeks.
Keep an eye out. And the best way to do that will probably be to follow The Fire These Times, because a lot of our episodes might be doubly released there. And you'll at least be able to get updates on all of these different podcasts that are going to be in communication and in dialogue with each other. And we're really freaking hype about it. So yeah, we hope you are too.
Thank you for listening. Bye.